A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on October 24, 1999, entitled Love, Not Fear. The texts for the sermon are 1 John 4, verses 7 through 21, and Luke 7, verses 36 through 50. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I caught an article in the New York Times about 6 weeks ago which said that the Reverend Dr. Mel White was going to be invited to dinner by Jerry Falwell of the Thomas Road Baptist Church in that marvelously named city, Lynchburg. And there was some talk about it at the time, but I had more or less forgotten about it. And then last night I caught just a little glimpse of a newscast, and there was Jerry Falwell and Mel White on the television screen together. And yesterday was the day. I didn't get enough of the newscast to give you accurate details. I know that what was proposed was that Mel White was to bring about 200 gay lesbian people to Lynchburg to have dinner with 200 of Jerry Falwell's people. The reason this came about was that Mel White had been sending open letters to Jerry Falwell on the internet, I understand. Mel heads up an organization called Soul Force. In fact, when he was here a couple of years ago, he led a seminar on Saturday morning, which some of you participated in. It is a seminar on nonviolence, and he borrows from Gandhi and from Martin Luther King, who borrowed from Gandhi, in the use of nonviolent protest in order to gain civil rights, human dignity, to change government structures, and so forth. And apparently, the word got through. You may remember that Mel White was a part of the inner core of what has come to be known as the religious right in this country. He did he was a ghostwriter for the biographies of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, and others. And he was very intimately connected with the leaders of that whole movement. Then he declared himself to be gay after years of anguish, years of struggle. He had been married, had children. He had gone through therapy, including all kinds of torturous attempts to prove to himself that he was not a gay person, and finally declared himself and lives openly now and is an advocate for gay rights, and particularly for his conviction that God loves all people, gay and straight and all the rest. So the dinner apparently took place. I did hear Jerry Falwell say, I stand where I have always stood, my biblical position on the practice of any homosexual engagement is wrong, contrary to scripture. And Mel White simply on the other side of that issue, but saying, I sit here with my brother in Christ. And the attempt, the reason for the coming together is Mel White's attempt to get leaders of the very conservative evangelical movement to lower the decibels of their rhetoric, the kind of rhetoric against the homosexual community, which certainly has got to be an element in the gay bashing and the violence that has so tragically been experienced in the last months and years. I did, at the end of the first service, someone came running up to me who had already seen the morning paper and said that Jerry Falwell is in trouble and is now the victim himself of protests, being called a hypocrite. by some of his religious colleagues for what they call a compromise of sitting down with Mel White. And so the story goes on, and you will know more about it. You probably know more about it than I do already. But anyway, I thought of that in the context of the dinner at Simon's house. There are not a lot of parallels between that account in Luke's gospel, but there's a sense in which what happened between Jerry Falwell and Mel White was something like what was happening between Jesus and Simon. Now, Simon, it has nothing to do with him being a Jew. It really has nothing to do with him being a Pharisee. It has everything to do with him being a serious, responsible, religious person who is very much committed to a tradition. A tradition that is very control-oriented in terms of being well-structured. All the rules are there. Everyone knows what one is to do and what one is not to do. Simon simply is a representative of the guardians of the moral and the theological and the biblical tradition. A good person. And a person who didn't need public letters on the internet. I don't think Jesus went to the internet. I think he invited Jesus, according to Luke, himself, because he was interested. Who is this man? And he also was not only interested, he was somewhat threatened by him, because it was Jesus' manner of life and ministry that is very threatening to a person like Simon. Jesus suggested that the marginalized were loved by God and had access to God. Jesus had table fellowship with all sorts and conditions of humankind. Jesus didn't play by conventional wisdom. I mean, all of this is old hat for us, I know, but nonetheless, this is what was going on. Jesus was a threat to a very traditional and tight religious system that knew who was in and who was out, that knew what was right and what was wrong. And I couldn't help thinking about that story, and then just being reminded about this encounter between Jerry Falwell and Mel White. If there were indeed 200 on either side of the tables from each contingent, I'd like to imagine Jesus there. What if Jesus had come into the room? What do you think? What if seeing Jesus there, after all he's been through, Mel White just got overwhelmed? I've seen him cry. I can imagine him throwing himself at Jesus' feet weeping. I think Jesus would have been very comfortable with it. I suspect that Jerry Falwell may have squirmed a little. Because when you think that concretely, where would Jesus' sympathies lie? Can there be any question about that in light of the nature of Jesus' ministry, his posture, his attitude, his spirit? I hope some good comes out of it. And I respect Jerry Falwell. No matter how much pressure was put on him, he apparently has sat down with the enemy. And there's conversation. And good can come of that. And he'll probably suffer for doing it. But I see it as a positive sign. Some of you read the newspaper with me in mind. Somebody sent me an editorial. Another person called me about it. It appeared in the Grand Rapids Press. I really do appreciate that. Hard enough to come up with sermons. It was by Richard Cohen. I think it appeared in the Grand Rapids Press, and it referred to that leading statesman of our day, Jesse Ventura. Jesse Ventura did a body slam on religion. And a colleague of Richard Cohen wrote an article chastising Jesse Ventura for doing that and saying, "Jesse Ventura, you forgot of all the sterling names of Christian leaders who have made a difference." And he named Mother Teresa and Reinhold Niebuhr and Martin Luther King and so forth. Richard Cohen says, but I have to say to my colleague, they're all dead. All the heroes are dead. And the celebrities today have taken quite a different tact. There was a time when the Reinhold Niebuhrs had the year of power and could speak a word for grace and for inclusion and for integrity. But today, the names that are bandied about and making news are names that are on the other side of the issue, time and again. And then Mr. Cohen refers to Eugene Carson Blake, a fine Presbyterian leader and World Council head back in the 60s, a time when some of you can remember the mainline church had to decide what it would do on the race question, and it finally, belatedly, stood up, took a stand, and moved, and the nation moved as well. And the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a consequence, not a little consequence, of the fact that the mainline church finally said, this is right. And Cohen points out the fact that those heroes that his colleague mentioned in the column were the people who called us to be better than we are, to be done with prejudice and bigotry, to inclusion and embrace. And he contrasts that with what is going on in our own day. And so he says maybe Jesse Ventura wasn't altogether out of line, but he points out the fact that the current crop of religious leaders, they don't ask us to accept homosexuality, and they refuse to deal with the consequences of their rhetoric, which leads to the gay bashing. And he says what's necessary is to do what was done, for example, in the church at large, recognizing that it's traditional anti-Semitism fed into the Holocaust. And he says they also do not ask us to accept and understand modernity. They reject it almost in its entirety, for instance, in the matter of science and religion. They simply reject science and believe religion, which is currently the case in Kansas, to which he points. There was a piece within the last two or three weeks about a couple in Kansas. Again, a very good and sincere people. But they and their pastor are quoted saying, if we lose creation, we lose everything. And then going on to say that the woman was a public school teacher who couldn't put conscience anymore in a public school, and so now she's in a Christian school, whose library has a book with an orange sticker saying, warning, this book contains statements about evolution, and who has a book on great scientists. It has the chapter on Darwin ripped out. Well, what's going on, friends? What's going on? Let me suggest that fear is going on. That all of this raucous is consciously or unconsciously rooted in fear. If I were to read another lesson this morning, I would have read the lesson from Genesis, the third chapter, about our forebears, Mr. Adam and Mrs. Eve, who bit the apple, felt their guilt, hid in the bushes because they were afraid. And that profound myth recognizes fear as something endemic in the human person. Maybe the fear even precedes the breaking of the commandment. Maybe the fear comes from that anxiety of splashing down the birth canal into a cold, wide open world, bright and cold. Whatever it is, there's fear in the human heart. And if I were to rewrite the Genesis myth, now there's presumption for you. I said it's a profound story, and it is. But if it were to be written today, we wouldn't have Mr. Adam and Mrs. Eve in their blissful perfection and innocence frolicking in the garden. We would have an animal with a dawning consciousness. And then consciousness of another. We would have the story of two animals becoming human. And in that becoming human, in consciousness, self-consciousness, and consciousness of the other, we would have the first glimmerings of the possibility of relationship and community. And in the further development, we would have the first glimmerings of the possibility of love in relationship. And we would understand, even as far down the line as we are at this point, in that evolutionary process of which we're a part, we would understand that there is a fear in the core of our being because we carry with us that whole genetic code. We carry with us that whole collective unconscious of the animal that survived because there was fear as a defense mechanism, an alertness to every threat, a suspicion of every movement. Who survived? Those who had the savvy to fear, and that fear, that threat to my person, had to be dealt with, and consequently, in spite of the fact that we have come to the point where we have learned to love and understand spirit and have left that primitive stage far behind, we are still people who very quickly become afraid. And what happens to an animal that gets cornered? And what happens to us when we come under threat? And I do believe that we are seeing it all over the map in our time. So much threat. Consequently, so much fear. Consequently, so much violence. Because you see, what we tend to do as religious people, and religion really is a defense mechanism against the insecurities of the abyss of life. And what we tend to do is structure something that's very clear, it's very solid and very sure. We want it secure. We want a place to stand. We want to know who we are, why we are, whence we've come, whither we're going. We want answers. Life is full of mystery. Life is marked by tragedy. Life participates in awful suffering. How do you figure it out? How do you exist? It's scary business. And so, one of the places we go for security, for certainty, for shelter and refuge is religion. And the more certain, the better. Give me a divine revelation. Give me an inerrant Bible. Give me an infallible Pope. So that in the midst of this stream of history that is ever moving, ever opening up into broader vistas, I have a rock upon which to stand. And when that rock moves, I become afraid. And when I become afraid, I can't love. Because love and fear do not dwell together. This is what John was saying in the fourth chapter of his first letter. Perhaps the most profound statement of the scriptures, perhaps the one we would take if we could have only one. God is love. Think of the implications of that statement. God is love. Think of the light that that casts on the whole human story, on the whole of reality. God is love. But you see, if John simply said that and stopped, it'd be one more propositional statement. It would be one more creedal affirmation. And it would be part of that belief system that we might cling to for security. And oh, how we want that belief system to be true, and how we want that belief system to be believed by everybody else, and how we want every other belief system not to be true. Isn't that true? There was an article yesterday in the religious section of the press that said that just down here south of us, in some meeting of deacons or whatever, came up the idea for a millennial campaign entitled, I think it's What if it's true? What if it's true? And the first proposition is, what if it's true that Jesus is the only way to God? Gosh, we want that to be true. Why do we want that to be true? We want to be true. We want to be right. We want to be right alone. The article said that we, Christ Community, could join in. They're gathering congregations now. You want to be a part of it? Buttons, flyers, posters, billboards. They're going to spend $243,000 at the turn of the millennium to suggest to underchurched and religiously deprived Western Michigan that it might be true. And I ask myself when I see that, couldn't we better take that effort and live out something concretely with our neighbors? Because that's what John says. He doesn't leave it with God is love. That's a creedal affirmation. Creedal affirmations aren't true because we believe them. You can't believe them into truth. You can't find security and certainty and peace in any intellectual formulation. It's in the experience of love, dear friends. That's what John was saying. God is love. And the one who loves dwells in God, and God dwells in that one. God is love. And the one who dwells in love abides in God, and God abides in that one. God is love. And that is experienced. That becomes an existential, experiential reality that puts my heart at rest when I experience concretely love. Because, John says, don't sit in splendid isolation contemplating God and fall in love with God. Well, there have been a few mystics throughout the centuries who were able to do that. But not according to John. John says, no one has seen God. But you can see one another. And when you love one another, you are experiencing the love of God and the reality of God. He goes on then to say, there's no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. It seems really simple to me, and I don't know what I'm missing. Honestly, I don't know what I'm missing. I want to keep saying, what are we afraid of? Why do we fear? Because it is true. Fear and love don't coexist. You've got hostility bristling across the table. You've got tension in the room. You've got over-againstness, adversarial spirit, mutual condemnation, threat. And down deep, we're scared to death of each other. And then somebody moves in and loves. Becomes the concretization of love, the embodiment of love. The Word made flesh dwelling among us. In this we know the love of God, that God sent the Son. This concrete experience of incarnation, the embodiment of God in Jesus. That's where it started. It was in that person-to-person encounter. That's where love was experienced. And where love is experienced, somehow or other, the questions dissolve and the fear is scattered. And where love prevails, there God is. John is so blunt, he says, don't tell me you love God when you hate your brother. If you can't love your brother whom you can see, who's flesh and blood, don't talk to me about loving God. So, this is my word this morning. Let us love one another and be agents of love out there in every situation, every conflict situation, in every place where somebody is being put down or marginalized or oppressed or taken advantage of or abused. Because we have seen what love is. We have seen what God is, because we have seen what love is, because we have seen love embodied. And we have experienced it, haven't we? Isn't that alone which transforms? It certainly is my story. The experience of unconditional grace. The experience of being embraced rather than shunned. The experience of being healed and helped and lifted rather than left and discarded. That's transforming. All of the rigidity and all of the sincerity and all of the responsible religious structure cannot change one human heart. Can give guidance, it can coerce, it can control, but only love can transform. And where love is, fear will not be. And where there is not fear, there will not be violence and the destruction of one another. God is love. Those who abide in love abide in God. There is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. And Jesus said to the woman, "Go in peace. You've got a lot of love."